Well, thank you very much. My name's Conrad, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just thinking, you know, why I drank. And the only reason I can say is that I never felt really well without drink. As a little boy of 6 and 7, I used to be subject to horrible moods of black depression, and I lived in a little village in Derbyshire, and there was a church called St. Stephen's, and it summoned its parishioners to this Sunday evening service by tolling a single bell. And it was like the knell of doom. I think they nearly said the bell of noom. It was like the knell of doom to me. It was a terrible sound, and it produced a kind of profound melancholy in me, you know? And in my teens, I was an anxious, disturbed boy. I had clammy hands, always wet hands, you know, from nervous tension. I felt tremendously inferior. Everybody seemed to be better than me. Whoever they were, they seemed to be better than me. And I envied them and wanted to be like them, whoever they were. And when I had my first drink at the age of 18, it was the Nottingham Palais de Love. And I was there with a cousin of mine who was a few years older than me. And I'd had no experience of drink whatever because both my parents were lifelong teetotalers. And I knew nothing about drink. And this girl said to me, would you like a cocktail? And I'd heard the word cocktail, but I had no idea what a cocktail was. And she bought me a Manhattan cocktail. And I sipped this stuff, which to me was... felt a wonderful experience because it burned as it went down, and I liked that. And then magic happened because my sense of inferiority went. I was able to dance better. I was able to talk better. My hands dried up. It was a magical experience. And this is what I've been looking for all my life, you know? Something that would make me feel comfortable, something that would make me feel at ease and equal with other people instead of persistently inferior. And I really thought I'd found the answer to my life's problems. And when I was a medical student, I started to drink regularly. And the first time I got drunk was at lunchtime, and I was in a pub with some other students. And I had 4 half pints of bitter. And the sort of disturbed inner me came out, and I laughed, and I cried, and giggled, and I knew I was behaving stupidly and hysterically, and I couldn't stop. And I didn't like this because it wasn't manly to behave like this, but this is what drink did to me, did for me. But I liked the feeling. I liked being able to laugh and cry instead of being sort of stayed and pent up and held in all the time. And I began then to drink regularly. I began to get drunk every Saturday night in the pub and let my hair down and sing bawdy songs and all this kind of thing. And it relieved the inattention. But it got hold on me very quickly. And until I started drinking, I was a very good student. Did very well in examinations and classes and so on. But drink began to interfere with my capacity to learn and my capacity to retain. My capacity to work, really. Because drink became more important than work. It became more important than anything. And I qualified in medicine. And after a few years, I just couldn't stop drinking. I was completely hooked on it. No way could I stop drinking. I wanted to. I was worried about the effect it was having on me. But it had got me. And I'd gone beyond recall. I couldn't do anything about it. And in 1937, I was doing a locum up in Lincolnshire, in general practice, and the doctor was away with his wife on holiday, and they came back, and he asked me to stay on for a few days and give him a hand. And they went out to dinner, and I did the surgery while they were out to dinner. And when the last patient went, I... locked the waiting room door and went back in the surgery, and I felt dreadful. I felt so low and depressed and miserable. And I went into the dispensary and I got a whole tube of morphine tablets. And I put them in a syringe and filled the syringe with hot water and injected it into my arm. And I took a number of sodium amytal capsules and swallowed those. And a few days later I woke up in Grimsby Hospital. And you know, in 1937, AA had been in existence in the States for 2 years, but there was no AA in this country. And I came out of this hospital and went home to stay with my parents in Derbyshire. I didn't know what to do. Just didn't know what to do. I felt I was tempted to go to a mental hospital and say, can you take me in? Can you do something to help me? But I didn't think they would understand. I was just recently a qualified doctor, and in the whole of my medical curriculum in psychological medicine, there was no mention of alcoholism, the illness. Plenty of mention of results of alcoholic drinking, you know, cirrhosis of the liver and Korsakoff syndrome and these things. No mention of alcoholism, an illness that you could treat. We really owe to AA this concept of the illness of alcoholism. And I went on from there. I had 3 months at home and then I got another job, and eventually I got a practice of my own down in the south of England near Canterbury. And what terrified me about my alcoholism was that when I drank, my behavior became quite unpredictable. You know, I would say to my wife, I'm just going down to the pub to have a couple of drinks. And quite a lot of nights, I would go down to the pub and have a couple of drinks and come home, like any normal person. But I never knew. One night I would go to the pub, and I'd be in a kind of self-destructive mood, an angry, self-destructive mood, and I would get drunk, and I would behave badly in the pub. As the village doctor, it's not a good thing to be obscene and offensive to other people. I did all these things as if I were trying to destroy myself and my reputation, and I couldn't help it. This is what happened to me when I drank. But it was perplexing, because I never knew when it would happen. And it might just happen 1 in 10 times, but it was always so serious for me. It was so serious for me, reputation-wise, health-wise, happiness-wise, because these things, these incidents filled me with remorse and shame and guilt, which I had to live with the next day, and I didn't know how to cope with these feelings of remorse and shame and guilt, except by drowning them with further liquor. And this is the way I tried to cope with these feelings inside. And I became so fearful of what alcohol was doing to me. When I was about 40 years of age, I started taking morphine. And I was addicted to morphine and heroin for 22 years. And for 22 years, there wasn't a day when I didn't have about 10 injections of these substances. I got it from my doctor. I couldn't start work in the morning until I'd been to my doctor and got something for the day. And when I got it and had it, I didn't want to start work anyway. You know, it stopped me behaving impulsively and self-destructively, but it slowed me down, and just to work to any effect at all was a tremendous strain. It was very difficult. So I dragged on until I was 60 years of age, lightning passage through my life. And when I was 60 years of age, I'd had enough. I'd retired from practice, and I went into a mental hospital, and I stayed there for 2 years. And they got me off hard drugs. But I felt absolutely hopeless in this hospital. At the bottom, you know. I dragged my feet around the miles of corridors trying to find something to do to pass an hour. There was a clock on the wall and it had a red second hand which swept round like that, you know. And I'd sit counting the minutes away because I didn't know what to do. I couldn't read. I couldn't write letters. I couldn't look at television. I couldn't do anything. They wanted me to do occupational therapy, and I couldn't bring myself to do it. I was just at the bottom, you know. I didn't know what to do with myself. I'd stand at the door, and I'd see a car come up the drive, and it would be a young fellow with his wife, presumably, in the front of the car, and he'd hop out of the car and come into the hospital with a parcel or something, deliver it, get back in the car, and shut the door and have a little laugh with his wife and start the engine, and down the drive they go into the outside world. And I wondered what had happened to me. That I was stuck in this place, you know. And I couldn't function. I couldn't operate in the outside world. I was incarcerated and institutionalized in this place. And I was 60 years of age, and I just wanted to be dead. I'd had enough. I used to get a pass from the psychiatrist to go home for the weekend. And I'd be dying to go home, you know, to get out of this hospital. Dying to go home. And my wife would come for me. I'd be so pleased to see her. And I'd get home and see the little dog and the garden and these things that meant a lot to me. I'm sorry about this, it just caught me for a minute. And I'd have lunch, and after lunch I'd want to be back in the hospital again. And I didn't know how I was going to put up with the weekend in the outside world. And this is how I was living. This was my life, you know. And when I came out of the mental hospital, I was off hard drugs, and I got a job. I'd retired from medicine, and I got a job working in greenhouses. They had 4 acres of glass, and they grew tomatoes. And I was working with young people. I wasn't much good, but the boss of the greenhouses was an old patient of mine, and he very graciously gave me this little job. I began to feel a little bit better. I was with young people, and I was doing something with my hands. And I used to go to work about 8 o'clock in the morning, and worked till 4 in the afternoon, and it was very, very sort of ordinary humdrum work, you know, repetitive work, but it just gave me a start. It gave me a foot on the lowest rung of the ladder of recovery. But I wasn't having any hard drugs, and I was drinking again. I was going to the pub at night, and then I'd come back in the afternoon at 4 o'clock, and I'd have a bath to get changed, and my wife would come into the bathroom and I'd have half a tumbler of whiskey on the side of the bath. And she said, "Oh, you're not drinking that stuff at this time of day, are you?" And I said, "Well, I need it to relax, you know, this sort of rationalization." And the thing was that without the hard drugs, I needed something like whiskey, and I couldn't stop again. And I began to get more and more sort of hopeless. Although I felt better working at the greenhouse, I was desperate about my state of mind and health. And one day, I rang up Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been drinking very heavily, and I was frightened. And I have no idea what made me ring Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been in practice in this village in Kent for 32 years, and I treated a lot of alcoholics. I used to send them into the mental hospital to be dried out. I'd never sent one of them to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never met anybody who was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd never seen a copy of the big book. I'd never been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just knew the name. And the extraordinary thing was that when I really needed help, desperately for myself, I rang Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know why. I just don't know why, but thank God I did. Because I was taken to my first meeting, and I sat in this meeting, about 20 people there, it was at Ashford, and I looked around the table, and the people around the table were sober and sane and rational. They were full of humor. They were warm and loving and welcoming. And I wanted what they had. And that first meeting in Ashford that night, I felt that I'd found what I believed. So sorry about this. It's so ridiculous. Come on me this morning. I felt that I'd found what I've been looking for all my life, you know. Just found what I've been looking for all my life. This is what I've been looking for all my life. And I wanted so much what the people in AA had. I had no quarrel with Alcoholics Anonymous from the beginning. I had sort of differences. I mean, I was a sort of angry atheist, and the idea of it being a spiritual sickness, I poo-pooed, but I didn't say anything. I didn't quarrel with them openly about it. I made a mental note to put them right when I knew them a bit better. But they started putting me right, and so that forestalled my effort. And I'm very glad it did, because I wouldn't have come out very well in trying to put them right. But I got to as many meetings as I could. There weren't so many meetings in those days. And, you know, I just took off in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was staggered by the simplicity of it. I was staggered by people saying to me simple things like, you just stay away from one drink, the first drink, this one day, just this one day. Get your head on the pillow tonight without having had a drink. And however difficult the day has been, it's been a great day. They said things like, it only has to be done once, you know? You can go back and go back on the drink and start all over again painfully, but it only needs to be done once. And I determined that it was only just going to be done once for me. But the first drink, you know, the magic of the first drink, I used to think, if I could just stop after four. I never got into any trouble, not real trouble, after four drinks, or even six. So if I never had more than six, I'd be all right. But they explained to me in AA that I was suffering from a sickness which was spiritual, mental, and physical, and that one of the symptoms of the sickness was a compulsion which was activated by having just one drink. This activated a compulsion which was absolutely irresistible. And I knew this. I knew it. Time and again I'd gone into the pub, meaning just to have one, and ended up drunk. I didn't mean to get drunk. I didn't say to my wife, I'm going out to get drunk. I said, I'm going out to have a couple of beers. And that's what I meant to do. Over and over again. I never learned by my own mistakes. And the concept of it being a sickness was a great comfort to me, you know. Because I'd been a terrible critic of myself. I'd savaged myself at the way I went on, you know. I couldn't understand the way I behaved. And when I knew that I got a sickness that really put it beyond my powers of control, I felt better. And I began to listen at meetings. I began to listen to people talking about their character defects. I was staggered at the honesty of the sharing at meetings. I remember I'd been in the fellowship a few weeks and a chap talked about his defiance. And I thought I'd been like that all my life. I've been defiant all my life. I defied my parents. I defied teachers. I defied university professors. Defied all sorts of people. Always been defiant. And, you know, working at the greenhouse, I had hours working by myself, trimming these old plants and de-leafing them and picking the fruit and that sort of thing. And I was able to think about the things that I was learning in the rooms. Able to think about character defects like resentment. I don't think I'd ever use the word resentment, but when I listened to people talking about their resentment, I began to understand what resentment meant. It was different from anger. It was anger that went on feeding on itself. You know, I don't know whether any of you, there are plenty of Scots people in the room, and they probably know Robbie Burns much better than I do, but Robbie Burns wrote a poem called Tam o' Shanter, and for people who don't know anything about Scots, Tam means Tom, and I presume Shanter was the little village he lived in near Ayr in Scotland, so Tam o' Shanter. And Tam used to go to the pub every Saturday night and get drunk. And his wife used to get home, and as Burns described him in the described her in the poem, gathering her brows like gathering storm, nursing her wrath to keep it warm. That's resentment. Nursing my wrath to keep it warm. Keeping it going, feeding it, you know. And I began to see how I'd always been resentful. I began to see the truth in that horrible word, self-pity, which was so lowering to my self-esteem, but I had to admit that I'd been full of self-pity. And you know, for a few years in the fellowship, I got on fine. I didn't drink, and I felt so much better. I felt a different person. But I did nothing about the program of recovery. I did lots about other things. I got involved, as they advised me to. I became a group secretary. I became a GSO. I became vice chairman of Intergroup. I came to this town to the General Service Conference in Manchester when I'd just been 2 years sober. And got involved, and I was well, but I hadn't really done anything about the steps. And I was perplexed about this. And I began then to realize that the thing that was getting in between me and getting into the steps to make them part of my way of life was the fact that I was still taking Mogadon. And Mogadon seemed just kid stuff after morphine and heroin, you know, of no importance at all. But to me, it was important because I was using Mogadon as a drug, you know, and instead of learning to trust people in the fellowship, to trust the program of recovery, to trust God as I was beginning to understand him, I was trusting Mogadon. And a chap who used to come to our meetings said to me when I'd been talking about my addiction to Mogadon, "How can you turn your will and your life over to the care of God and take a Mogadon?" And I didn't understand him, but I never forgot him, and never forgot what he said, and those were his very words. And that was in the first year of my recovery. "How can you turn your will and your life over to the care of God and take a Mogadon? If you're going to trust God, the trust has to be complete. You have to let go of other trusts, other props, if you like." And Mogadon was the one I had to let go of. And it took me 4 years after I came into the fellowship and stopped drinking. But I'm glad I did. You know, some people said, "Well, half the population of the country is on Mogadon. What are you worrying about?" But there were other people in the fellowship who said to me, "It's a drug and you're not really letting go and letting God if you're taking a drug." So I had to let go, and I didn't find it easy. I found it much more difficult to let go of Mogadon than I did to let go of alcohol. And I think the main reason for that was that it was the last chemical crutch, you know? And having let go of the last chemical crutch, where did I turn? I had to turn to the fellowship. I had then to take step three, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I had such difficulty with this step. I read it and read it and read it. I read it in the 12 and 12. I read about the door shut against you, and you had to put the key in the door and turn the key, and the key was called willingness, and if you did this, the door would open a little. And I wish they wouldn't talk in parables. I wish they'd talk plain English and tell me what to do. I was intellectualizing it, you see. I didn't know what to do. And one Wednesday, I got so angry, I felt like leaving the fellowship. It's too difficult. They ask too much of me. I can't understand what it's about. I don't understand what I'm supposed to do. I've had enough. This was the kind of feeling. And if I hadn't been secretary of Ashwood Meeting, I wouldn't have gone that night. But I went, and I didn't enjoy the meeting. I couldn't think of anything except the pain inside me and the rebellion, the anger, the frustration, the defiance, and all these things which were churning up inside me. And I got home, and I was alone in the house. And I was sitting in the lounge, and I thought to myself, if you have made a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God, you'd better tell God. And when I went to bed, for the first time in my whole life, I got on my knees at the bedside. And I said to God, I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to be doing, but I have made this decision that I want to turn my will and my life over to your care. And I got into bed, and I slept like a baby all night. And when I woke in the morning, these feelings of defiance and anger, fighting, had all gone, and I felt tranquil and wonderful. I'll never forget the experience. You know, looking back, I only have to be willing to try. I'd have to be willing to put the key in the lock and turn it. That's all. He's not making great demands on me. I only have to make a little beginning. And the little beginning produced a magical effect. I never forget how I felt. And from then on, I was hooked on the steps. I did 4 and 5. And doing 4 and 5, you know, in retrospect, I feel that before I did steps 4 and 5, the attic of my mind was a dark room. It was lit just by 140-watt bulb, and it was a big room, and I couldn't see in the corners. There was a bit of old carpet there, and a couple of old suitcases there, all covered with dust, and in the corner a pile of rubbish, and there might be something nasty in there I couldn't see because it was full of rubbish. There might be a rat in there, you know, something menacing. This was my mind. And since doing step 4 and 5, I feel as if the attic of my mind was a brightly lit room, lit with strip lighting, and that I can see into all the corners, and all the rubbish has been taken away, discarded, got rid of. It's a brightly lit room. There's nothing there to be frightened of. And 6 and 7, you know, asking God's help with my defects of character. And then waiting his good time, not expecting a result that morning, that day, or tomorrow, waiting his good time. And 8 and 9, you know, making amends. One of the difficult amends I had to make was to my old dad, because if he were alive today, I think he'd be 111. When I came into the fellowship, he'd been dead for years, and I had a very bad relationship with him. And I can remember thinking when I was about 18, if ever I get married and have children, I will treat my children very differently from how you've treated me. My father didn't drink. He had a difficult personality. He wasn't an easy person to get on with. He had some of the alcoholic mental tendencies, you know, capacity for self-pity, for anger, resentment. Not an easy person. But he was a good father, and in many ways he was a very good father. And you know, in steps 8 and 9, I was able to look at the way I treated my children. And you know, in spite of that 18-year-old determination never to treat my children the way he treated me, I treated them worse than he treated me. This was it. And I was able to see that he was just a person. Because of this magic relationship, father and son, he, you know, I expected things of him I'd know right to expect. He was just a man with all the internal difficulties that I had, trying his best in his own way to cope with his problems. And when I came to see him in that way, love took the place of hate and resentment, fear. I used to be frightened of him. And love came into our relationship. If I saw my father in the street today, I'd be so delighted to see him. I would love to see him. That's how I want to feel about him. I can't do anything in direct amends because he's dead, but I can have the image of my father that's contained inside me altered to a loving father by my loving him, and that secures me inside, because I don't want hate objects inside me. I don't want people and fearing and hating inside me. I want my internal world to be peopled by loving objects. Step 10. That's a marvelous step. Step 10 governs my relationships with people in my day, in this day. You know? It's a spiritual axiom, it says in step 10. That when I am disturbed, whatever the cause, there's something the matter with me. I want to look out and say, if it weren't for what, the way he behaved, if she were different, it's all in here, you know. Look into myself. Change myself. There's something the matter with me. And also asks me, in my personal relationships, to practice self-restraint. And this to me is of vital importance. I was so good, you know, at blaming other people, going for other people, telling them what to do. And now, today, I practice self-restraint. And I have good relationships with people. One harsh, nasty word can spoil a day, a month, or a year in a relationship, or destroy the relationship forever. Because although things may be forgiven, they're not forgotten. And today, because of practicing step 10, I find that I walk much more gently through the lives of other people. And step 11, I have become very God-conscious. From being an arrogant, noisy atheist when I came into the fellowship, I've become very God-conscious. I'm conscious of God in everything. I'm conscious of God in this room this morning. I'm conscious of God in the outside world, in the trees, in the sunshine, in nature. I'm conscious of God in my relationships with people. I'm conscious of God in other people. I never do anything without telling God I'm going to do it. Coming to take this chair this morning, I went to my room beforehand and got on my knees and just asked a little prayer to keep ego out of the chair. Not to let me try to be clever or instructive or any of these things. Just to be myself, to let God's message flow through me as far as I can. And God never lets me down, you know. I never forget step 3, you see, taking step 3. It was an illustration to me that if I'm willing to communicate with God, the gifts that he gives me in return, they fall out on me, you know? And step 12, carrying the message to others. Having had a spiritual awakening, which I have had, I'm not in any doubt about my spiritual awakening. As a result of these steps, I try to carry this message to other alcoholics. That doesn't mean going and sitting with a chap who's sent for me because he's drunk or is at the end of his death. It doesn't only mean that at all. It means being here with you, to other alcoholics. You know, you needn't be drunk just because you're an alcoholic. To people who are trying to stay well and practicing these principles, the principles behind the steps in all my affairs, which I try to do each day. And you know, here we come to this I owe to AA. I'm so grateful to AA because I sometimes feel, you know, that if I think, say, at night about gratitude, especially if I got into a bit of a negative state, bit of self-pity or something like that, and I think, what have you got today to be grateful for? And when I start to think, it tumbles out of me like a cupboard being opened and its contents falling out. The things that I have to be grateful for tumble out and hit me. My health, which is superb. My sobriety. fact that I have enough money to come up and join with you in Manchester, you know. To come away and have a loving weekend with you in Manchester. I have a wife, married in AA, we're both in AA, in the fellowship. The fact that I have the sort of recovery that makes it possible to be loving to my wife, to be generously disposed towards her, not to want to quarrel with her and needle her and bring her down and so on, which was my wont for so much of my life, trying to score points and so on. Just to be together and enjoy this marvelous adventure of getting well. All these things, they just come tumbling out. I don't have to look far, you know. I find that gratitude is the biggest antidote to my negative feelings of all. Because how can I feel sorry for myself if all these gifts have been given to me? What more am I wanting, you know? It's ridiculous. Gratitude is the biggest solvent for my negative feelings. And everything, you want me to finish? Yes, I will. Everything I have, I owe to AA. What's this? You come to speak. She's displacing me. I'm a displaced person.